From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. In the throes of the Beslan school hostage catastrophe last week, the Russian government reverted to the standard procedure employed in previous crises, from the sinking of the submarine Kursk to the deadly 2002 theater siege to the recent terrorist downing of two airliners. It lied. But is it possible that the latest embarrassment, which met with harsh criticism even on a Kremlin-controlled TV channel, will finally coax the government into being more honest with its people? Is it possible that in his vestie, a front page consisting only of a harrowing photograph, a man carrying a wounded Beslan school pupil, bespeaks an end to the reflexive suppression of bad news? Fred Weir, Moscow correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor, believes he can answer those questions, and the answer is no.
On the whole, Russian TV was pretty tame. During the crisis, they reported exactly what they were meant to. They repeated uncritically what they were told. And there hasn't been any really loud or consistent backlash from them. The print media is a bit different and showed a little bit of spirit in the last few days. After having been fed such a diet of fibs and cover-ups last week, what that shows is that the Russian media isn't completely straitjacketed, that there are possibilities to express itself. But the aftermath of this hostage crisis, I think, shows that the Kremlin is extending its control to the print media.
I guess we should note that Raf Shakirov, the editor-in-chief of Izvestia, lost his job a few days ago because of his coverage of the crisis. Tell me what happened.
Well, he put very evocative photographs on the front and back cover. Izvestia is a broadsheet, so he essentially turned it into a poster with these very dramatic pictures, and it appears that he was fired for that. Why? I think that the idea in the Kremlin is a very Soviet notion that bad news should never be played up. And Shakirov had the idea that newspapers should reflect the mood of its readers, and therein was a clash.
Is there no concept in Russian life of the public's right to know?
Well, yes. You know, most of the people in Russia grew up in the Soviet times. They learned to read between the lines of the newspapers, and Russians have reverted to that. They continually listen to rumors and give more credence to rumors nowadays than what they hear on the news broadcasts. They are aware that they're being lied to, but how to change that is the central problem.
Can we take heart at all from the nearly 4 hours that Putin spent with the press? I'm trying to think of an American president who has had a four-hour press conference. Certainly not President Bush. Can we take heart?
Don't think so. He met with foreign journalists and foreign academics at his dacha for 3.5 hours, and he did talk across a broad spectrum of issues. But he does that. He's very well informed. He's very sharp. And I think the Kremlin is quite worried about its image abroad. And that might explain why he met with this foreign group. Russian journalists are upset that in the aftermath of the school crisis, he has yet to meet with them.
Putin castigated the Western press for calling the hostage takers rebels rather than terrorists. The nomenclature of describing terrorism has been an issue in the West as well. Is this the first time questions have surfaced in the coverage of the Chechen guerrillas?
No, this is a standard theme on the part of the Kremlin, that there are double standards. When American targets are struck by militants of some sort, they are invariably called terrorists. But when Chechens strike at Russian targets, they can be called rebels, insurgents. Although in the case of the school crisis last week, I think we all called them terrorists.
Do you have any sense that as a result of this crisis and the hand-wringing about the coverage that has ensued ever since, do you think any corner has been turned that would permit news to be covered as news without being first vetted for its potentially negative political consequences?
I don't see any sign of that. And you must remember that every single time we go through these crises, whether it was the sinking of the Kursk or the Nordost crisis 2 years ago, officialdom seems to congenitally lie. They tell such fairy tales about it, sometimes seemingly to no purpose at all. And we always go through this hangover afterwards as we, all of us, foreign and Russian journalists, realized just what a lot of malarkey we were told. And in all of those times, nothing has gotten better. Officialdom hasn't learned that it's better to tell the truth. If that happens as a result of this particular tragedy, the signs of that are yet to be seen.
Well, Fred, as always, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Fred Weir is the Moscow correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor.
Across the rest of the world this week, there were less measured responses to the tragedy at Beslan. Some columnists, unsurprisingly, framed it in the larger context of the global war on terror. What was surprising was the analysis that emerged in some corners of the Arab press, where commentators reacted with what only could be called shame. Writing in the Jordanian daily Al Dastur, columnist Bater Wardam wrote of the Arab tendency to, quote, place responsibility for the crimes of Arabic and Muslim terrorist organizations on the Mossad, the Zionists, and American intelligence. But we all know that is not the case. They came from our midst, he wrote. They are Arabs and Muslims who pray, fast, grow beards, demand the wearing of veils, and call for the defense of Islamic causes, he said. Therefore, we must all raise our voices, disown them, and oppose all these crimes.
More important still was the column written by Abdul Rahman al-Rashid, who is both a columnist in the London-based Arshak al-Awasat and general manager of the Al Arabiya satellite TV network. In his column titled The Painful Truth, All the World's Terrorists Are Muslims, he observed, our terrorist sons are an end product of our corrupted culture. He went on, most perpetrators of suicide operations in buses, schools, and residential buildings around the world for the past 10 years have been Muslims. The picture is humiliating, painful, and harsh for all of us. Lee Smith writes about Arab media and culture for Slate. He joins me now. Lee, welcome to OTM.
Hi, thank you very much.
First, let me ask you, how representative of Arab media overall was al-Rashid's reaction to the carnage at Beslan?
I think that his column was probably the strongest, most forceful expression, and that's why it was reprinted in a number of different English-language venues during the course of the weekend. I mean, it's also, he's a significant character since he's not just a writer, but he's the general manager of a fantastically influential television station. Again, I think his was the strongest expression, though there was certainly a fair amount of outrage.
Well, in general, what are you seeing more of, this sort of self-criticism or defensiveness?
Usually we see more defensiveness, and I think for the most part we're still seeing that as well. I mean, there are a whole bunch of standard formulations that are used in the media. I mean, there's one that goes something like, if the worst enemies of Islam had decided to attack the religion, they couldn't have done anything worse than what these guys did. Instead of really criticizing the action, they're still looking themselves to defend Islam. I mean, you know, Islam is a great religion. It doesn't need defense. It's these actions that need to be criticized. Another formulation is something which we've heard since 9/11. The people who did this were not Muslims. This is preposterous. Why not just say something like, they're bad Muslims, they did the wrong thing, but quite clearly they believe there's some connection between their idea of Islam and their terrorist operations.
There are other pieces written, one by a prominent cleric who blamed the whole Beslan tragedy on the Israelis, whom he said had staged the operation to bring discredit on Islam. And then there was another in that same newspaper, Al-Sharq al-Asset.
Yes, I mean, this was unfortunately a very standard Arab world discourse. Both the idea of blaming the actual operation on the Israelis, or Zionists would be the proper phrase. We saw this after 9/11, where many people are still convinced this was a Mossad operation. And then, yes, there's a lot of trying to draw equivalences between what Ariel Sharon does and what various Islamist terrorists do throughout the world now.
I want to get back to al-Rashid's introspective editorial.
Uh-huh.
Do you think it portends anything greater, first in the Arab media, but also, I think, in the Muslim world at large? I guess I'm grasping at the hope that Beslan will be some sort of turning point when the moral bankruptcy of terrorism becomes plain even to those who have rationalized it and even those who have actively embraced it. Am I hallucinating here?
No, I think Beslan may play a part of it, but I think probably the more important thing to look at is Arashid's actual position. He's an influential columnist at Ashark al-Awsat. He has a piece in there at least once a week, usually more often. The fact is, no one really knows how many people read Arab newspapers. You know, not that many. Many, many more people listen to Arab radio and watch Arab TV. So the really important thing is that he's the general manager of Al Arabiya. And we know that Al Arabiya has had a lot of problems of late. It's unfortunately looked much too much like Al Jazeera, especially in reporting from Iraq. But the people at Al Arabiya, you know, when they originally started the network 2 years ago, they wanted it to be the moderate alternative to Al Jazeera. The idea that the man they have in charge now is a very self-critical, liberal figure, I think that's what's important to look at, his actual role and how that station will basically affect Arab society. So, yeah, I see the Beslan thing as part of a larger reason for hope, which may just actually have to do with the station itself.
Do you know if Al Arabiya is catching on, if its audience is beginning to overtake that of Al Jazeera?
One of the problems is that we really don't know how many people are watching Al Arabiya, how many people are watching Al Jazeera, because ratings aren't done in the Arab world the way they're done, for instance, in the U.S. Ratings are very tightly controlled. I mean, also, there's a lot of very large sections of the Arab world that are hard to keep track of. Some of the ratings that we do know about, though, there was a Gallup poll conducted in Iraq about 5 months ago, I guess now, where people found out that they watched Al Arabiya as much as they watched Al Jazeera. And I think Al Jazeera is still probably by popular acclaim the most influential network in the region. But whether or not it's always the most watched news network at all times, that's really tough to tell.
Okay, Lee. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Bob.
Lee Smith writes about Arab media and culture for Slate.com.
Next, what recent history can tell us about the upcoming candidates' debates and the Dow of covering hurricanes.
This is On the Media from NPR. This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Although the presidential campaign has been dominated thus far by candidates sniping at each other from remote locations, they won't have that luxury in the upcoming debates. The Atlantic Monthly's James Fallows observes in a recent article that these key election events are shaping up to be a kind of clash of the debate titans, despite or perhaps because of the candidates' profoundly different styles. Rarely in the past have George W. Bush or John Kerry tasted defeat, but Fallows suggests that when the sparks fly this time around, one of the candidates is sure to get burned. James, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Brooke.
So first of all, what matters most in these debates? Do viewers tune in for policy debates or for contrasting personalities?
To the disappointment of debate coaches everywhere, it's not really the contest of logic. And indeed, if you were scoring debates that way, you would have assumed that Richard Nixon had beaten John Kennedy in 1960 and that Jimmy Carter had beaten Ronald Reagan in 1980. And of course, the debates in both those years were very important in the opposite direction. So debates really have mattered in the course of presidential contests, and it's been mainly because one of the candidates manages to project something about his approach to life, his personality that voters who are undecided connect with, or he forces his opponent to reveal something that drives voters away.
Is the fact that debates are so important the reason why there wasn't a debate after the famous 1960 Nixon-Kennedy debates for another, I don't know, 15, 16 years?
Well, there is no kind of official system for forcing candidates to have debates. Every year, including this one, it's a matter of negotiation. And there is this Commission on Presidential Debates. It tried to psych out both campaigns early this year by saying there's going to be three presidential debates and they're going to be on these dates and these places and one vice presidential debate. And it shrewdly put all of them in swing states, thinking that would make both campaigns, you know, reluctant to say no.
Doesn't the incumbent get to pick what the format is, whether it's one moderator or a panel of moderators or even face-to-face talk?
In reality, yes. Again, procedurally, it's a negotiation and each side has its objections. The debate commission this year proposed that all the debates be single moderator, and that actually was a good thing from almost everybody's point of view because we journalists can't resist hogging the airtime. And if a single moderator is able to sort of back himself or herself away from the foreground, he can occasionally let the candidates go directly at each other.
Last time around, PBS host Jim Lehrer was criticized in the press. He was a moderator because he sat so far back, he never asked any follow-ups. And Kerry himself told the New York Times 4 years ago, you could have picked 10 people off the street who didn't know Jerusalem from Georgia, and they would have picked better questions than Jim Lehrer. What do you think the role of the moderator should be?
I think it's an almost impossible position that the debate commission is in, because think of the world from their point of view. They have to find something that Karl Rove plus George Bush and John Kerry and his whole campaign team are both going to agree on. And so it is almost inevitable that sort of reverts to a kind of tameness in the questioning. And what one can hope, again, is that the moderator, Lehrer, and the others who've been picked for these single roles will try to make the most of this historic opportunity that that they have.
Now, for your article, you watched the candidates' old debates a lot of times over and over again. What did the old debate tapes reveal first about Bush?
The most amazing thing is that Bush 10 years ago, for whatever reason, simply sounded like a different person from the President Bush we know today. He spoke quite quickly. He never mangled a sentence. The sentences all had sort of appropriate grammatical form. He had one or two, you know, mispronunciations, probably fewer than I'm having right now. He didn't stammer and pause before grunting out a big word, as he often does now. Essentially, he sounded more like his brother, Jeb Bush, who's a perfectly articulate speaker, than he does like the man who's been our president. And the most riveting 60 minutes of debate film I saw when preparing for this Atlantic article was the debate between Bush and Governor Ann Richards of Texas in 1994.
The brilliant silver-haired, saber-tongued orator from Texas.
Indeed. She was the reigning queen of Democratic oratory at the time. And if you were judging this debate either on points or emotionally, the way audiences do in presidential debates, you'd say that Bush won by a mile, as in fact he went on to win the gubernatorial election.
I want us to stop and remember that there are a lot of people in Texas and Southeast Texas that are out of their homes tonight, and I want you to remember when you go home to say a prayer for them.
Mr. Bush.
Well spoken, Governor. I think that the biggest thing Texas must do is to end the post-Vietnam War syndrome, which blames others for society's ills. All policy in Texas must say to each and every individual, you're accountable for your behavior.
So what stood out for you about John Kerry's past debates?
The big surprise with listening to tapes of John Kerry over the years is he always sounds the same. Kerry himself was on Meet the Press earlier this year, and there were some clips of him having been on the same Meet the Press show in his mid-20s in 1971, and if you closed your eyes, you couldn't really be sure whether it was the 25-year-old Kerry or the 60-year-old Kerry who was talking.
The men who ordered us, the men who signed off the air raid strike areas, I think these men, by the letter of the law, the same letter of the law that tried Lieutenant Calley, are war criminals.
The words were honest, but on the other hand, they were a little bit over the top. And I think that there were breaches of the Geneva Conventions.
But also when it comes to his debates, he had a sort of martial artist dexterity and agility. And this was highlighted most in his debate with William Weld in Massachusetts. He and Weld were very similar in many ways, but Kerry was able basically to out-dance and out-parry and out-maneuver Weld, and that was part of his coming back to win his race for re-election to the Senate 8 years ago.
Like Muhammad Ali against Sonny Liston.
Well, the Liston and Clay image would be actually more appropriate to the Kerry-Bush showdown this fall.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you were to sort of reduce these two people to sporting metaphors, which of course we would never want to do in politics,
never.
You would say that Bush's great strength is a kind of relentless heavyweight slugging. Again, like Sonny Liston or other great strong punchers of the ring, whereas Kerry at his very best is like Cassius Clay or Muhammad Ali dancing around time, whatever you're doing, he's sort of doing it faster. Whether that will happen this fall with Bush and Kerry, we just don't know.
Yeah, because you don't get to do it with your fist. All the polls suggest that the public will forgive George Bush practically any superficial gaffe. So I wonder whether a zinger, even if it squarely hits its target, will really make much of a difference.
If the zinger from Kerry is, aha, you've got the wrong name for the president of Uzbekistan, no one will care. But think of Dan Quayle against Lloyd Benson for the vice presidency in 1988, where Quayle was trying to boost himself up by saying that John Kennedy had also been a young man of high office. And Benson came back with, I think, the largely unscripted business of, you know, I knew Jack Kennedy and you're no Jack Kennedy. One reason we watch these things is that something we can't anticipate now is going to happen. And that surprising thing will have a big effect on the election.
Let's talk a little bit about how the war rooms are setting up these debates. Both of them seem to be engaged in raising expectations for the opponent. I think the Bush war room recently announced that John Kerry is so good, he's like Cicero.
It is like the point spread in sports, and the Bush team has been absolutely brilliant in playing this expectations game, where every single time so far they've said their upcoming opponent is so fearsome that if their candidate can physically survive the encounter, that he will, in effect, have won. The realistic fact is that both these people have won all the debates they've had before, Bush and Kerry, and so neither of them should be gaming the expectations against the other, and it will be a real championship match.
Okay. Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
James Fallows is the national correspondent for the Atlantic Monthly.
Hurricane season is only half over, and already two giant storms, Charley and Francis, have taken dozens of lives in the southern United States. Now Florida's Gulf Coast anxiously awaits Ivan, boiling through the Caribbean, straight in its direction. Needless to say, this is terrible news for everything and everyone in its path, except, of course, the media. Author and journalist Carl Hiaasen lives in the Florida Keys. This week, his excerpts from the non-existent Handbook for Roving Hurricane Correspondents appeared in the Miami Herald. Among the tips offered to local TV reporters, when the storm finally comes ashore, always stand dangerously near the rough water and position yourself so that the spray hits you directly in the face. If it's not raining yet, take off your hood and let the wind mess up your hair. Remember, a wet, tired, and weather-beaten appearance is crucial to your credibility as a hurricane journalist. Among the required footage, says Hiaasen,
palm trees. That's the iconic Florida storm shot, is bending palm trees. Now, the secret that nobody who lives in Florida tells everybody else is that a palm tree will bend double in the tiniest rain squall. They bend and they bend, and they actually very seldom fall down. But the palm fronds curled over and the trunk of the tree bending is very dramatic. So unless you want to lose your job in television, you better come back on that satellite truck with some seriously bending palm trees. You know, those are requisite shots. You have to follow the panic-stricken. The plywood going up is a standard shot. The standing in long lines and the gas lines are standard shots. And then after the storm hits, obviously the falling trees are the main thing you have to get.
Yeah, you've even listed the ideal shots in your column in order of priority. First being big tree on strip mall, then big tree on house, big tree on car, small tree on car, assorted shrubbery on car.
Well, during Francis, I swear, there was one broadcaster. The storm hadn't hit yet. We'd been waiting and waiting. And she breathlessly rushed outside, and there was a little bit of rain and a little bit of wind, just like any old summer squall. But she pointed to a car where a palm tree no more than 3 feet high has fallen against the car. And it was comical. This was the hurricane, this little tiny palm tree. Augusta was, you know, you could have blown it over yourself. But that's the desperation that sets in when you don't have the right kind of footage and the right kind of visuals.
You've identified a few catchphrases that you constantly hear in the coverage. So what are some of them?
The most popular one during Francis was, conditions are deteriorating, because over 4 days they were. And that was a good standby. The other one that came up always was everybody should just hunker down and stay out of the weather. You know, well, you could tell that to a small Pomeranian, and he would have already figured it out on his own. You talk about how awesome it is and how you've never seen anything like it, even though if you've ever covered a hurricane, you've seen something exactly like it. Doesn't really matter. But, you know, there's only so much you can say about this when you're standing there waiting and waiting and waiting for the weather. That doesn't become cliche and doesn't start to sound kind of silly after a while.
Undergirding what is a very funny column on the subject is at least the implication that TV broadcasters really trivialize the seriousness of these gigantic storms and the devastation that they do, in fact, wreak by going to all these gimmicks for making the genuinely dramatic seem even more dramatic. Do you think there's actually something ethically wrong about behaving this way?
No, you know what? I don't think they have a choice. The competition is so intense during these. They're all running around like gerbils with their feet on fire during these storms. I feel bad for them because I know their producers want them to get this kind of footage, even if they said, hey, look, wouldn't it be smarter if I just stood behind this building and then the viewers could actually hear what I'm saying? They'd say no, because it's not as dramatic. And so they put them out there, and a female reporter this last storm got hit with a piece of concrete material and broke her rib. You know, that, of course, that was worth many, many minutes of airtime. In addition to the thousands of people who are left homeless, we have this reporter with a broken rib. But it's sad because these things are horrific. They are devastating. They are everything you've ever heard they would be. What they're not is surprising.
Well, that raises the question about the very definition of news. South Florida, in the late summer and early autumn, hurricane comes through. Is that news?
Well, it's news if you're talking about the displacing of millions and millions of people, which is what happened. Now, all the chaos that brings with it is newsworthy. At any rate, what happens if you live in Florida and you go through enough of these over the years is you hopefully develop a little bit of a threshold of skepticism and also patience, because even with Ivan, which is bearing down on us, they're evacuating the Keys even as I'm sitting here, most of the locals aren't going anywhere until we know more about where the storm is going. Because what happened during Andrew, for example, is a lot of people bailed out of the Keys and went up to Homestead, Florida, which got flattened by the storm. They would have been better off staying in the Keys, which didn't hardly have any damage at all. So the valuable information is coming off the radar and out of the weather center. The fact that it's pouring rain in Stuart, Florida, when you're in the eyewall of a hurricane, hardly qualifies as a big news bulletin to the folks in Stuart, Florida, or anywhere else.
All right, so, Carl, journalistically speaking, in three words or less, how would you describe the state of hurricane reporting in 2004?
in three words or less? Oh, my
God. Oh, for God's sakes, Carl, say conditions are deteriorating.
Oh, there you go. Oh, yeah, I got you. Oh, I got you. Conditions are deteriorating.
Okay, Carl. Well, thank you very much. And listen here, Ivan's coming. Hunker down.
I got you. Thanks a lot, Bob.
Journalist and novelist Carl Hyacin's latest book is Skinny Dip. He spoke to us from his home in the Florida Keys as Ivan closed in. Last year, as Isabel, the last hurricane with an I name, bore down on the East Coast, I Velcroed up my trusty windbreaker and headed out to try my own hand at the fine art of storm reportage.
I'm standing here on the deck of my home in Virginia being buffeted by the rain and wind of Hurricane Isabel. I'm here because I live here, but it's an image that you're probably not unfamiliar with these past few days.
Yeah, are you batting down to something right now?
I'm hanging on to a planter, and that's the only reason that I'm not blowing away. I don't know if you can see this thing.
Where our car was being moved in reverse against our will, just because of the sheer force of the winds. We're obviously getting a lot of...
Yeah, we're here. We're up against the generator. I think my buddy Mike took a tumble. I can just hear the folks at home saying, you know, they got what they deserve.
Not an unreasonable reaction, but they might also wonder whoever sent them. Jerry Silberman is one such. He's the news director of WTOC-TV in Savannah, Georgia. We spoke to him just as Isabel was working up ahead of steam.
Larry, welcome to On the Media.
Thank you.
Who do you have on the scene where the storm is making landfall?
Currently, I have one of our primary anchors, Mike Manhattan, a photographer, and two engineers with our satellite truck.
Within the last few days, it's been quite clear that Savannah was going to be spared. How exactly will the people of Savannah be served by having Mike Manhattan on the scene at a hurricane that will never come near them? What's to be gained?
There's always lessons to be gained. You know, we're documenting history. You know, those who don't learn from history are doomed to repeat it. for a city like Savannah, that's a coastal community, and every year we're facing threats of hurricanes, then any time we can bring that closer to our viewers so they can see how other hurricanes are creating damage, destruction, havoc on a region, then it gives everyone here the greater appreciation for what they need to do next time.
All right. Let me ask you an obnoxious question. It's obnoxious, but it's also, I think, the essence of the thing. If Mike and the crew come back and you've had the only Savannah coverage live from the center of the storm and they have an exciting time and they get the news, I guess it'll be high fives all around. But if their truck is hit by a fallen tree or if they get caught in a flash flood and drown or something else horrible happens to them, then what are you left with?
You know, I don't know that my feelings would change if something tragic or horrible happened. You know, I'd look at it and go, what did we do wrong? And move on. And, you know, each time you learn and become smarter about it, I feel comfortable that I'm not putting someone at great, great risk here. You know, we have a public service to cover news when and where it happens. And, you know, that's what we do. And we're a voluntary army. I mean, no one was drafted in and forced to do anything. People do what they do in this business because they love what they do.
All right. Well, of course, I wish Mike and the crew well, and thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Larry Silberman is news director at WTOC-TV in Savannah. We spoke last year a day before Hurricane Isabel made its landfall. You'll be happy to know that Mike Manhattan and his crew made it home safely.
Coming up, should reporters be political? Can we stop them? And the network that Time forgot.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from this and other NPR member stations and the Kresge Foundation, building the capacity of nonprofit organizations through challenge grants since 1924, on the web at kresge.org. The Kellogg Foundation, helping people help themselves by investing in individuals, their families, and their communities, on the web at www.wkkf.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, making grants to improve the health and healthcare of all Americans, on the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. We don't believe in objectivity anymore. We know it isn't possible. And yet the public expects reporters to be objective, to give them the facts without infusing them with bias. But to what lengths should reporters go? Some are gay, some are black, some are disabled, some are Christian, Muslim, Jewish, yes, even Republican. Should they be expected to report fairly on beats that encroach on their personal lives? Bob Steele, an expert in journalistic ethics at the Poynter Institute, says, it depends.
I do believe it's appropriate for journalists to live meaningful lives. I believe it's appropriate for journalists to practice their faith if they wish to do so. I believe it's appropriate for journalists to vote if they wish to do so. There's a big difference in my mind between going to church and becoming an activist in a sense of a public display.
Journalists should refrain from activism, says Steele. If you go to church, don't volunteer in the parish public relations office. If you're disabled, don't lobby your congressman for street ramps. If you're gay, don't march in the parade. Vote if you want to, but don't put a campaign sign on your lawn.
We restrict our reporters' political activity.
Michael Scholar, managing director for news at Minnesota Public Radio, says the policy applies to everyone, from political correspondents to arts reporters.
So that means you shouldn't register as a member of a political party, you shouldn't participate in a Minnesota caucus, you shouldn't attend rallies or show any other public support for a party or a political cause.
With the exception of restricting party affiliation, which is unusual, his is the policy that prevails in most newsrooms. But just because you don't trumpet your beliefs doesn't mean you don't have them.
This notion that journalists ought to be sort of political, ideological eunuchs who don't have any political views is just hopeless.
Michael Kinsley is editorial and opinion editor for the Los Angeles Times.
The question isn't whether they hold opinions, but whether they suppress those opinions to the extent they can when they do their work.
When Kinsley was the editor of Slate, he disclosed who he was voting for and invited his reporters and editors to do the same. Mostly they did. He admits it was less risky for Slate than for other news outlets because Slate is a journal of commentary and analysis, but...
I think newspapers ought to do it precisely because it's a fiction to suppose that reporters don't have political views. And it would be healthier and more honest if they simply said what they were.
Len Downey, the editor of The Washington Post, is the poster child for the opposing view, the one that says reporters should keep mum. But he takes it even further. When executive editor Ben Bradley handed him the reins 20 years ago, he stopped voting.
Unlike the rest of our staff, I had the last word as to whether or not the paper was being fair in its reporting on these issues, and I didn't want to take a position even in my own mind on them. I wanted to maintain a completely open mind.
And so, despite all the information that flows through your desk and all you know about the political environment of Washington, D.C., you are able to not make up your mind?
Yes, actually, it comes fairly easily to me. I guess it's the nature of my personality to see all sides of most issues. In fact, I'm rather surprised at people that are so definite about things.
Did he say he can bend forks with his mind? You know, some people can do remarkable things.
Michael Kinsley.
I mean, Len Downey, I admire. But I'm not sure that I would admire him as much if I thought that he was really able to go blank in his mind as easily as he claims to.
The argument against laying your cards, assuming you have any on the table, is twofold. One says that if reporters state their conflict of interests right and left, editors would have to bar them from covering certain stories because the public wouldn't trust them to be fair, even if they were. It's about appearances. We'll return to that one. But there's a second, more intriguing argument, the one that says that taking a political action makes your views stronger. Minnesota Public Radio's Michael Scholar.
When you kind of put a sign up or put your money where your mouth is, you move from observing to acting. And I think that changes you internally. I mean, you can even see it when people purchase a car. You know, how many friends have you had where they struggle with what car to purchase, and when they finally purchase it, they try to convince all their friends how brilliant their decision was. That, you know, kind of putting a stake in the ground makes you vested.
Ethan Bronner, deputy foreign editor of the New York Times, spent decades on difficult beats and managed not to get vested in his stories, even when reporting from the most polarized place on the planet.
I spent many years in the Middle East, and I have, you know, views on what should happen or what could have happened or what has happened. But I also think that the most important view I have is to keep my mind open to the idea that my own view may be wrong.
He might say bending forks with your mind is part of the job.
I don't think it's a question of being more honest to come forward and say, this is what I think, because I think that once you announce your view, you persuade yourself in addition to others. Whereas if you force yourself not to come to a conclusion about a difficult question and to leave yourself open, you will stay more open.
Michael Kinsley concedes that the best argument for keeping your views to yourself is...
that there's a feedback loop. Yes, that's a clever argument, and I wouldn't say it's worthless. The argument that I do think is worthless is the argument that you shouldn't do it because of the appearances. And I feel pretty strongly that the job of journalism is to make appearances accord with reality, not to make reality accord with appearances.
As we've seen recently, hypersensitivity to the appearance of objectivity can lead to some lousy reporting. We saw it in the coverage of the Swift Boat Veterans for Truth. We saw it in the run-up to war. A reporter should be able to call a lie a lie, but the conventions of American journalism, so attentive to appearance, make it tough to say that. In the news pages, official statements come first. Challenges appear after the jump. News analysis arrives in a box deep inside the paper. Not so in European newspapers, where news analysis and commentary commingle, sometimes in the same story. That's the approach Kinsley prefers.
They're overtly opinionated, and you can call it bias if you want, except that they're totally open about it. And they are judged by their readers with that in mind.
In the British case, there is that tradition of being much more overtly adversarial about things.
Jeremy O'Grady is the editor-in-chief of The Week in London.
There is a very traditional ding-dong between left-leaning and right-leaning papers, which tends to up the ante quite a lot. They do look at each other a lot of the time and take account of their arguments and throw them back.
Ethan Bronner says that we should not seek a cure for what ails the American media in the European press.
I think that would be a big mistake. The editor of Le Monde, for example, will, on a given day, gather his editors around him and say, okay, let's have a main editorial saying that the Iraq war is wrong. Let's get a feature out of Baghdad showing what's problematic about it. And I want a front page story that does something else similar to that. Whereas it seems to me that we come to work every day saying, what's it going to be like today? What elements, what interstices of truth are we going to discover today? And I don't mean this in a naive fashion. I think that we consciously try to keep our perspective on whether it's a good or a bad thing at bay in order to report it as best we can.
But American reporters are people, too. They tend to be biased in favor of freedom and democracy. They couldn't get a decent job if they took what could be seen in another nation as a balanced position on socialism, say, or Osama bin Laden. And our values change with the times. What might have passed for balanced coverage of slavery 200 years ago would read like lunacy today. The fact that no one has a corner on the truth could be used to back Kinsley's argument.
You start with the situation of reporters trying to do their best to be objective, but having views because they're intelligent human beings. Why don't we just find out what their beliefs are, let the readers know, and let everybody go about their business?
But the slipperiness of truth also makes Len Downey's case.
So many of the most important public issues do not have a clear-cut right and wrong. And in fact, the public divides evenly over them. And if one of our journalists covering that issue were to have a strong conviction on one side or the other, it would be impossible for them to cover that story fairly. It is very difficult for non-journalists to understand how so many journalists, so many people who choose this profession, and particularly choose to work with the ethics of the Washington Post, have chosen almost to be monks, if you will, to be observers, not participants, but observers. That's what we do here.
Although the truth can be elusive, you can often find it in the facts. But while the big stories dominate the front pages of our great newspapers, when it comes to politics, the unpalatable facts are frequently buried deep inside. This year, the cloistered monks at both the Washington Post and the New York Times issued mea culpas for sidelining the truth. Perhaps the problem is not with the principle of objectivity, but with the form. Print who's lying right after the lie, right there on the front page. Tell us the facts before the jump, and we don't need to know who you're voting for.
As everyone knows, the big three broadcast networks, NBC, CBS, and ABC, have been around since the dawn of time, to be joined only 20 years ago by upstart Fox, which is true, but incomplete. In TV's earliest days, there was another network, a pioneering enterprise that, through the 40s and early 50s, aired some of the most popular programs of its day. It was called the Dumont Network, and its rise and fall are chronicled in a new book, The Forgotten Network, Dumont and the Birth of American Television. David Weinstein is the author, and he joins me now. David, welcome to the little upstart we call On the Media.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
When I think of the early mythic television moguls, I think of men like David Sarnoff of NBC in his general's uniform, or William Paley, who ran CBS for decades, industrial titans and visionaries, and certainly larger than life personalities. And then there was this Caspar Milquetoast, Alan B. Dumont. Who was this guy?
Alan Dumont was a scientist and he was an engineer. Now, Dumont was not one of these figures like a Sarnoff, like a Paley. He was not larger than life. He was a shy man. He was most comfortable tinkering around with different equipment in his laboratory. But because of his skills as an engineer, he decided to get into television and he found himself in the thick of the industry.
There seems to be a paradox here. On the one hand, in your book, you describe Dumont as a sort of techno geek fiddling with the controls behind his TV to improve the picture, but not paying any attention to the actual program. On the other hand, he built a substantial manufacturing business and a TV network. So he clearly wasn't entirely clueless.
He had the right people working for him also. A lot of the people who worked at Dumont were young, creative. They were thrilled to be working in television. and there was not a lot of middle management. And Alain Dumont himself did not try to dictate the programming that Dumont would broadcast. And they created many of the programs that defined early television, shows like Captain Video, The Cavalcade of Stars with Jackie Gleason.
Let's talk about Captain Video for a moment. This, I would say, is just before the so-called golden age of television began. It was still quite experimental.
Fighting for law and order, Captain Video operates from a mountain retreat with secret agents at all points of the globe. Possessing scientific secrets and scientific weapons, Captain Video asks no quarter and gives none to the forces of evil. Stand by for Captain Video!
So, David, Star Wars, it wasn't.
No, it wasn't, but kids especially were not looking for Star Wars at that time. They were looking for energy. They were looking for excitement. It was the kind of show the critics didn't totally understand, but the kids loved. They had things like the atomic rifle, which was basically a toy gun with a muffler on top, and other seemingly futuristic weapons that were purchased from the 5 and 10 cent store.
When you say a muffler, you're talking about an automobile muffler, no?
Literally an automobile muffler taped onto a toy rifle.
Among its other pioneering efforts, you write that Dumont essentially invented daytime television. How did that come to pass?
Yes, at the time, no other broadcaster was broadcasting during the day except for an occasional ball game. One of the reasons for that is that the other TV networks also own radio networks, and they wanted to protect their radio interests by not having television compete with radio. Dumont, on the other hand, wanted to sell TV sets and it wanted to stimulate television. They had shopping programs similar to the Home Shopping Network. They had television kindergarten, telling moms to put their kids in front of the TV while they taught coloring. The moms could do the dishes, and then they would make a loud noise at the end of the program so the mom would know to come back and watch the child. They were very conscious of trying to create programs that would fit the rhythms of the housewife that was the ideal daytime viewer.
Now, you would think that as perspicacious as they were in understanding their audience, that they might have had some advantages vis-a-vis the other networks who were coming from a radio culture. But you write that from the very beginning, the Dumont network really struggled against NBC, CBS, and even ABC.
Yes. Unfortunately for Dumont, in 1952, the FCC released its major allocation decision, and it only allocated four or more stations in seven markets. What this meant for Dumont and any other company that wanted to start a fourth network is that it would really only have access to seven markets, and that was not enough for the network to be viable. So by 1955, the Dumont network had ceased operations, and Alain Dumont was no longer in charge of the company. Dumont Broadcasting was changed to Metropolitan Broadcasting. Later, it became Metro Media.
And would be purchased by whom in order to start what?
To Rupert Murdoch, and that became the foundation for the Fox network.
What legacy of Alain Dumont's essential vision do you think is most lasting in 2004?
They helped to establish many of the genres that have continued to this day. We talked a little bit about daytime television, talk shows for women, crime dramas. One of my favorites was a program called The Plainclothesman that was shown totally from the point of view of a detective. You never saw him on screen, but you saw everything through him.
Hero without uniform, unknown, unsung, but always on guard, protecting you against crime.
And in some ways, even a show like Cops, which tries to take you on a ride with the police officer, is similar to The Plainclothesman. And if you go through a number of genres, variety shows, comedy, Dumont aired a program called Cavalcade of Stars, for example, which starred Jackie Gleason. Jackie Gleason developed The Honeymooners on that program. I don't know if we would have The Honeymooners without Dumont.
David, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Bob.
David Weinstein is the Senior Program Officer for the National Endowment for the Humanities and author of The Forgotten Network, Dumont and the Birth of American Television.
I stand it too. Somebody, Ohio. I've got the cutest little Ohio. There ain't nobody half as pretty as she, as sweet as me,
And jump it, deep as creatures. She's crazy for me. What am I, oh my, oh, the only one I've met who ever thrilled me so. She's not a glamour girl or no movie star, but when she's out with me, she's Hedy Lamarr. And when she, oh, 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 just wait till I get back to, oh, I, oh.
Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Jackie Gleason. That's it for this week's show. On the Media was directed by Katya Rogers and produced by Megan Ryan, Tony Field, and Derek John, and edited by Brooke. Dylan Keefe is our technical director and Jennifer Munson, our engineer. We had help from Ann Kossoff and Mike Volo. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Arun Roth is our senior producer and Dean Capello our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. This is On the Media from NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Boy! You are a dandy crowd.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the William T. Grant Foundation, helping the nation value young people as a resource through research and programs, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. The Charles Stewart Mott Foundation, online at mott.org, supporting efforts to promote a just, equitable and sustainable society, and the National Endowment for the Arts. Support from the media comes from the Bydell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.